Welcome to the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and on the second Monday of every month, we feature a tech expert who is here for an hour at least to answer your questions. Whether it is your Wi-Fi, your printer that won't connect, or the Internet of Things around your house that continues to grow, our guest Jesse LeGrew returns. He is the Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. And Jesse, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Good to be here.
I want to start with the basics here. Before we get to the complications that are artificial intelligences or quantum computers, let's just talk about the internet that we have in our home and how it works. In essence, how an internet service provider delivers and whether or not we know we're getting what we're paying for. Jesse, tell us a little bit about the path that our data takes from an internet service provider to our home and back again.
Yeah, and generally this is, usually we have, in many cases, physical connections to a lot of the different infrastructure that we have. For, you know, people who may be in other areas, it actually could be wireless. So usually there's some way that we're connecting to our internet service provider. It could be through a satellite, it could be through wireless, it could be through a physical plug that we're usually connected to in our home or somewhere else. In the end, all of that cabling or wireless transmission goes to something that our internet service provider controls. And in the end, that connects to something else, which basically ties a lot of the internet together. And it's really just a variety of places that are really, you know, connected via wireless or wired connections to give us access to the internet, to give us access to other devices that might be within our home or even in our neighborhood.
And the signals that they're sending, Jesse, they're digital, right? So does that mean that they're all binary, that everything that's being sent back and forth is either a one or a zero and that's it?
In the end, yes. Everything is a one or a zero. And, you know, it gets converted from a lot of our other computer systems so that, you know, when we go to a website, we don't have to think about any of that. It's all translated in the back end. And, you know, we just go to www.wpr and, you know, we get a website, we see it. We don't need to think about where it's, you know, how that all works in the back end. So we're pretty lucky to have a lot of the technology that doesn't require us to think about how it all works.
But when you think of how complicated everything has become, it's almost, it's difficult to wrap your head around the fact that it's all ones and zeros by the time it gets down to the actual transmission of information.
Right, right. There's a lot of complicated systems in the middle that really, you know, help to make everything work. In the end, as end users, we don't have to worry about it. But even just how data gets transmitted on the internet, and even how we do visit a website like www.wpr.org, there's a lot going in the background to understand, well, where should I go to get that website? What does that name mean? And when I get all of this information and I present it to an end user, in this case, you know, it's a web browser, how does that web browser actually put all of that information together for a user to see it? So behind the scenes, there is a lot of different communications and software that's working to help make sure when we go to a website, it gets presented to us in a way we can easily interact with it.
And Jesse, when it comes to the hardware in our own house, we get the signal from a wire or perhaps from a satellite, but that goes into our modem. And then our modem either includes a router or that information goes into a router. And then from there, all those ones and zeros are going into our computers, our cell phones, our printers and laptops. Is that the travel path that this information data takes?
Generally, that's the case. And when people do look for internet service providers, it's one of the reasons when you do look to get some kind of internet connection from an internet service provider, some options may not be available. And part of that is just due to the fact of not having maybe those physical cables in place where you can easily connect to it from your house, your apartment, or whatever else might be. In the end, usually a physical connection is needed. You know, looking at those situations where we are using a physical cable. So it does help to demonstrate why you always can't connect to the provider you might want.
And when we're talking about Wi-Fi, then a wireless way to connect to a router or a wireless modem that would allow us to connect to the internet, are we still talking about ones and zeros being transmitted back and forth?
Yes.
Wow. And how does that get secured then? How does somebody not reach out into the ether and grab those ones and zeros and steal your information?
And a lot of this, there's a few different ways this is protected. Looking at a lot of what we've used in the past, a lot of security wasn't really included by default. So one thing I think most people think about, phones. Let's just talk about phones. By default, it is an insecure way to communicate. It was never really thought in terms of how we could secure those communications. It was more interested to make it work, right? How do we make sure, you know, person A can speak to person B? Over time, we've tried to add security after the fact, which is generally how we kind of see the internet today. So when we tell people, hey, go to this website and look for the little lock that tells you this information is protected, which means, you know, it's encrypted. So if somebody is trying to read your information, maybe it could be your internet service provider as an example, how can we make sure that information is private? One of the ways we do that for web browsing, which is probably the way most people interact with the internet today, is to make sure we're using encryption in the form of these certificates, which basically allows us to have, you know, a key and a lock, generally something that is randomly generated. So no one has to, you know, you're not necessarily using the same key every time. That key changes, which means that even if somebody grabs your key, it only works for a limited period of time. So we do try to make sure those are in place for a lot of web communications. But, you know, looking 20 to 30 years ago, that wasn't always the case. Most sites may have not actually tried to use certificates to encrypt those communications, which helps to maintain some of that privacy. But even then, just because there's a lock doesn't mean it's actually secure. So
that little logo in the address bar of our web browser, I feel like is important enough that probably needs to be a little bigger, at least in the web browsers that I use. That little lock is a much bigger part of the equation of online safety than I think it appears on the screen.
Yes, yes. Yeah, and I think a challenge really is, and we try to, at least in security or just IT in general, for people using computers, we like to say, hey, if you do this, it's secure. And there's so many instances of, well, if you do this, it's probably secure. But there's this very, very small, plausible situation where somebody could still be reading your information. And so, you know, there, like anything, we talk about layers of defense.
Yeah.
And part of that is knowing this is probably secure. If it wasn't, what else could I do to make sure or to minimize the risk to my information?
It's just fascinating to me, Jesse, that we could have such an easy user experience most of the time and such a complicated behind the scenes black box on what's actually going down. But at the end of the day, the transmission that's being sent is either a one or a zero, and there is nothing in between. It's pretty basic at the start, gets complicated in the middle. And for us, it feels pretty basic when we're able to use it without problems. However, folks do have tech problems. We'll start with Cecil in Madison. Cecil, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thank you so much for having this show. My question is about passwords and portals online and how I have so many passwords to keep track of and like email addresses that I've created and remembering all those passwords and how to access them and where do you have any recommendations for the average layperson?
Well, what are you using now, Cecil? I'd be curious to know.
You mean in terms of like passwords?
Yeah. How do you remember all your
passwords?
Yeah.
Well, I've got the passwords manager on Google, but it doesn't save all of the passwords.
Right.
And then I'm probably not alone in having more than one email account too. And so like remembering when you log into a website that you haven't been to for like a year and trying to remember where that password might be or what username is, and you know, there's, it's just, it's very hard. And yes. I was wondering if he had any recommendations.
I appreciate the question because I would have the same question for Jesse. Jesse, what do you think?
Yeah, so one of the items, and you know, there's a lot of technological items we can think about. Password managers is generally something we recommend for anyone, mainly because it's such a challenge to remember a lot of the passwords that we have. You know, a long time ago, maybe we had 5 passwords, maybe we had to think about. In a lot of those cases, we might have reused it, right? So to make sure people use unique passwords and to make sure that those passwords can be kept track of, we do recommend password managers. A lot of the time, I'd recommend online or offline password managers. So one of the challenges with, let's say, a browser password manager, if it's not using like a centralized service, if it's through Chrome or Firefox, without having what they call like a master password to help encrypt that information, it can be really easy to grab it. So the we always recommend using a centralized password manager or making sure you do have a vault, centralized vault password that helps to encrypt that information on your device. So talking about that little lock, we want to make sure that little lock is there even for our stored passwords. And so that can be a challenge with some of the browser passwords. A lot of those services, if we're using mobile devices, they might synchronize. So they might actually have some encryption in place, whether that's using a centralized Google account password manager or using an Apple password manager. There's actually a lot of them out there. A lot of services that people use virtual private networks or they use different email services. You might actually see password management services kind of being bundled with that. And those online password managers allow you to synchronize the information with multiple devices. So while you might have the password manager on your browser, well, now you can use it on your mobile device. Now you can also use it on your laptop and your desktop. And so it allows you a little bit more mobility with that information. And it also allows you to store passwords that may not be directly related to a website or to a portal. Maybe it's password recovery information. Maybe it is a file you want to encrypt. A lot of these password managers allow you to store that additional information. So I would recommend look for a centralized password manager. Also, I would tend to look for one that is likely not free. So one of the things we tend to look at is what is, you know, my monetary investment. We do like free solutions because, you know, money is money and we want to save our resources. One of the challenges with a free resource is they always say, you know, you might be the product.
Yes.
What happens with your data? So
yes.
Usually by paying a little bit more money, you are also gaining some additional services. So those terms of service and how they protect that information is going to be extremely important. So I do recommend find something that works for you, something probably that you could pay for, or maybe you're already paying for. So a lot of people might already be paying for an Apple subscription or a Google subscription. You might already have services you have available that will help centralize everything. Otherwise, another good option, and I'll list two. One is another technical one, which is an offline password manager, which you can store on your computer. You can store it on a flash drive. It allows you to, you kind of have to open this program usually and copy and paste passwords, but it does allow you to keep that in a separate area where you can copy it and you can have it to a different location. It's a little bit harder to work with, which is usually why a lot of these online password managers tend to be more of an interest because the usability is just much greater. Otherwise, I'd also recommend, and people, you know, will ask, what if I use a notebook? What if I physically write it down? For me, if it works for you, I would say, you know, that's a success. One of the things people are usually careful about when writing down passwords, you know, we don't want anyone writing down their password on a post-it note and putting it under a keyboard or putting it on their monitor because, you know, it might be publicly available.
Sure.
People might have access to it. But if you have a notebook that's at home or even in a safe or in a place that's more protected, they still have to get into that physical area to get that notebook. And so when you think about the ways people can get access to that content, think about how easy would it be for somebody to get it. If I have an online password manager and it has all of my passwords, but it's protected by a weak password and anyone can log in anywhere in the world, that actually could be more of a risk than having a physical notebook that's stored in your house that, one, people physically have to be in the area to even get access to it, and they'd have to break into that area and know exactly where to go to get that notebook.
They'd also have to be able to read my mother's handwriting, which I believe would be the biggest barrier. So
yes.
My mom's offline password manager remains the most secure that exists. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to WPR News. It's our Tech Update Monday with Jesse LeGru, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College, taking a look at your tech questions and what we can do to solve them. And we'll go to Josh in Eau Claire next. Josh, good morning.
Hi there. Just commenting on your latest story about the password managers and maybe a point in favor of the online password managers. Not pleased to admit it, but I felt... I got a text message purporting to be from my bank and clicked it. Then the password manager that I used didn't fill in my information, which was good enough for me to look at it more closely, figure out that this was a phishing attempt, and I didn't ultimately get any further with it. But I think that the online password management is a has an additional layer of security there against phishing attacks.
That is a great story, Josh. So a password manager actually would not autofill when you got had a phishing attack. So it knew that it was not going to the right site, although you had yet to learn that, but your password manager sort of led you to down the road to figuring out that you were being attacked.
Yep, exactly.
That's a great story, Josh. Thank you for sharing. And certainly, I would imagine, Jesse, that is an argument for an online password manager that is well secured.
Yeah, I think having that kind of information, supplied, or in this case, not supplied, through a password manager can be really, really helpful.
Yeah.
It's one of the things we also think about with kind of multi-factor authentication technologies. So, you might get a prompt on your phone, for example, if you need to sign into a service. If you get a pop-up and you're not signing in anything, that's a good indicator, hey, somebody else might be trying.
Hold on, Jesse, just for those, the multi-factor authentication, I think those of us in the UW system have to use it umpteen times a day, so we're very familiar, but maybe those who are retired or aren't, ultimately trying to stay secure online with your company or whatever, how does this work? What's the multi-factor authentication mean?
Yeah, so usually when we think about getting access or kind of proving that you are who you say you are, we have a lot of different ways to do that. The most common way we do it every day is through what we call something which is usually a password.
Mm-hmm.
But there could also be a variety of other ways to prove that you are who you say you are. That could be presenting a physical ID, so something that you have. In the technology, you might hear about pass keys. This is a new thing. And so it's actually something that you physically have. For most multi-factor authentication, it tends to be a something you have. So most people will use a smartphone as their method for multi-factor authentication. It usually requires you to register a device. And so this device is required in addition to that password to make sure that you can get access to a service. So if somebody manages to guess your password, or maybe they did find that sticky note that was sitting on a monitor, even if they're able to use that to try to sign into a service, that second factor, which is part of that multi-factor, so having more than one, that second factor will kick in and you might get prompted on a device. And it may be, you know, I allow this connection, or maybe you have to verify two digits or another code in your device to make sure that you're the person actually trying to do the thing that's being attempted. And if you don't meet that second factor, it won't allow you into the service. And so that's a beneficial thing, because even if you know everyone's password for all of the things, that second factor helps to, you know, block access without having any other item.
Jesse, when I'm given an option, do I want to use multi-factor authentication for specific accounts? Would my default generally be yes for security reasons?
I would try to turn on multi-factor for everything if you could. Mm-hmm. That being said, you know, that can be challenging for a variety of reasons. One, not all services actually allow it, even today. I have seen even areas that may hold sensitive information. They may not require multi-factor authentication. Those are usually one of those things where I might also question whether I actually want to use that service, especially if they do require sensitive information.
Interesting.
Most commonly, and this is likely to happen to us rather than us signing up for it, our banks might just require it.
Yeah.
So you want an online access to your bank, it may require multi-factor authentication in order to access your account. Obviously, financial information is going to be sensitive. So in order to protect that, they want to make sure that only you are able to access it, and that it's at least a higher likelihood that it's going to be you and that somebody else is breaking in.
Let's go back to your calls now for our guest, Jesse LeGru, Chief Information Security Officer for Madison College. Laura and Madison, you're next. Good morning.
Well, good morning. Thank you. I'm calling because I have a laptop at home, and earlier this year, I got messages saying, you're on system 10. Mm-hmm. System 10 will not work after September. And I, you know, checked. I said, you need to upgrade to system 11, and here are the things you need to verify your computer has in order to do that. And so it looked to me like my computer, which is newer, had those things, and I planned to upgrade. But it never worked when I tried it, and recently I got a message that your computer is not new enough to support system 11.
Hmm.
But my computer is still working. So can you explain to me what's going on?
Yeah, and you are not alone, Laura. I've got another caller here who has the same question about the Windows operating system number 10, which updates expired, I believe, at some point last month. And Microsoft wants everybody to upgrade to Windows 11, their newest operating system. But for those with old hardware, it might not be available. They might not have the specs required for Windows operating system 11. Jesse, what is Laura and others like her to do?
Yeah, so first, in terms of, you know, what happens if you can't upgrade? So if for whatever reason you're unable to go from Windows 10 to 11, your device might still work. You're going to still be able to run programs. If you have browsers like Chrome and Firefox, those will continue to get updated because those are updated separately from Microsoft Windows itself. The one thing you will not get is Windows updates. That might include security updates, feature updates, really anything that Microsoft might release to keep that up to date and have new feature enhancements. The challenge behind that really is going to be security updates. Vulnerabilities and software happen all the time. And so one of the reasons to really move from 10 to 11, once again, if you're able, is to make sure that you are getting those updates that helps to limit the risk to your device and to any malware that might be on your device or any software that might be vulnerable that otherwise wouldn't be protected.
But Jesse, in Laura's situation, it looked like she had the hardware to be able to upgrade, but when the time came to upgrade, she was unable to do so. Would a fresh, and it said that now that her specs wouldn't work for the new operating system from Microsoft. And part of me thinks that, you know, a fresh install might be best, but I worry that a fresh install of Windows 11 might not work because there are some mixed signals that Laura's getting about whether or not her computer could handle it.
Yeah, there's probably a couple things that I recommend. So they have a PC health check that's available where you can
through Microsoft?
Through Microsoft,
okay.
That you can download, and basically it will tell you, hey, do I meet the requirements or not? So every now and again, when using some of these programs, usually the big question I have is this really coming from Microsoft, right? Is it not a virus or some kind of malware? So going directly to Microsoft's website, and they will have a health check to see if you can upgrade. It's at least a way to double check whether the information you're receiving is accurate. In addition, I would also recommend if you do have local areas that do computer repair or do any kind of service on devices, that could be another good amount of input where somebody can actually see the device. They can help you run through that process to make sure you're getting the best information.
Would you, I'm curious, Jesse, if you had a Windows 10 computer, would you still be using it for banking or shopping or credit card information or bank account numbers?
I would not.
Okay.
Primarily because it's going to be potentially insecure. Yeah. I'd say just about every device out there is going to have its flaws. But when you can't patch those or you can't fix those, you know, it becomes more and more of a risk over time.
Yeah.
Right now, you know, it's been about a month. But if you fast forward 12 months, that's a year of potential vulnerabilities for people to find and take advantage of.
So
which
Laura's probably good for now, right? At the time, most likely. But as we move on here, it'll become less and less secure.
Right. Yep. It becomes more risky over time when not being able to get those updates. So I would recommend, you know, a fresh install could be good. That being said, you still want to back up your data. You just never know. Any kind of upgrade or a significant upgrade to a computer, you still want to make sure you have good backups. So I do recommend, you know, make backups of your system. A different area might be able to help you try a fresh installation of Windows. Any area that might do computer repair or computer service could help you through that process. But I would double check the specifications that Microsoft has and use their online tool. If it does say you don't meet the requirements, unfortunately, there's only a few things you can do. One might actually be you can upgrade your device a little bit to get past those limitations.
Okay.
The downside is some devices, especially newer ones, are becoming harder and harder to upgrade.
Yeah.
Where the components you want to, you know, improve, you can't do without replacing larger portions of the device.
And that would also be true for laptops, right? Because Laura's got a laptop and that's all crammed in there.
Correct.
Yeah.
Especially for laptops, it's going to be more challenging. Usually for most desktops, you're probably going to have more flexibility. Mm-hmm. So if it's RAM, random access memory, that's where all your software is basically running. Usually you can upgrade that in a desktop. And a laptop, you probably can, but it depends on the manufacturer. So another good reason to go into an area that might service computers, because they can also help you identify, maybe you don't meet these requirements right now. Here's what you need to do in order to meet them. And at least this is the possibility for doing it with your existing device.
Yeah.
It'll at least let you know, do I need to buy a new system, which is a possibility, or can I upgrade something to get past that limitation and upgrade to Windows 11. Even if you can get past that limitation, I would still question, you know, do you want to buy a new one or do you want to upgrade? Primarily because will the experience be as good just by getting the bare minimum?
Right.
You do want your computer to run well with Windows 11 and get the patches and new releases as they come along. And so making sure you have not just the minimum specifications, but maybe a little bit of extra just to make sure that the experience of using that device is going to be something you actually want to do.
Laura, I thank you so much for the call, and you are not alone, as we will now prove as we go to Julia in Winona, Minnesota. Julia, good morning.
Good morning. I have a Lenovo laptop with Windows 10 on it. And about 3 weeks ago, when I turned it off, it said that I had an update, which I thought I'm not supposed to have one. And then the computer came back on. And since I was leaving, I turned it off. And the next day when I turned it on, the keyboard did not work. And since I didn't know what to do, I just went to the restart icon. And when it came back on, the keyboard worked. And now every time I turn the computer off, that's what I have to do is restart. And I talked to my computer man, and he said that he'd had a lot of people asking about that, and that it was a Microsoft thing, and he had no idea of what to do.
Wow. But you figured a workaround here. It's just a hassle that you've got to restart the computer every time you start the computer.
Yes.
Oh, Julia. And you said, is it Windows 10 that you're operating on? And it said you needed to update, and when it updated, are you still on Windows 10? Do you know?
I'm sure I am.
Huh. Well, that is interesting. Jesse LeGrew, what can we do?
So there's a couple items that I would think about. So for all the devices on our computers, they have things called drivers. It really tells, like Windows in this case, how to actually use those devices so that, you know, you don't have to think about it. You can use your keyboard, you can use your mouse. I kind of get the impression it might be an issue with a driver that was installed that might be making the keyboard work.
What's a driver?
A driver is really the software that allows all of the hardware on your computer to function.
Oh.
It tells Windows, here's how you interface with the keyboard or the camera or the display. So it's software to make all of that hardware work. And so every device has its own driver that helps to make sure your operating system, in this case, Microsoft Windows, is able to talk to it.
So it may be an update of a driver, or Windows might have updated the driver to something that was faulty and they may need to roll it back.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a possibility. So, I mean, one of the things I would take a look at, Lenovo does have a support website where you can download drivers for your device.
There you go.
It's possible they may have an application where you can download the latest driver, or it'll have an application where it can check just to see, hey, I see you're running Windows 10 or 11. Let me just check all your device software to make sure it's at the latest version. So that might be able to help resolve it, assuming it's going to be a driver problem. Mm-hmm. Another possibility is you can actually run updates again on Windows. So not all updates happen well. And so that means patches or fixes are released after an initial update is given.
Especially if Julia's computer guy was saying that she's not alone, that he's heard this from other people, that it sounds like maybe the pushed update may have been faulty itself.
Right, right. So I would actually go back to, if you hit the start button, you can type in Windows up. Well, I'd say type in, you might have to restart first, unfortunately, in this case. But go to Windows Update or go to Settings. And if you click check again, maybe it finds a new update. Maybe there's something that will actually resolve the issue. Another way to go about it, and this would be for, you know, if you're talking to your, you know, local computer tech, you can also go to something which is called Device Manager. It allows you to see all the devices on your computer, and it can actually let you manually update some of the software. You might see an item for the keyboard, which will have a listing. Delete it, which sounds really weird. Once again, so this will be for your local technician. You might just want to delete the keyboard and restart the computer. This will force the computer to reinstall that software. It might use the same version. It may use a different piece of software. But that's an area where you can at least try to customize the driver software that's being used for the keyboard. Maybe it'll help. Maybe it won't. The challenge here is we don't know if the software is going to fix it without Windows 11, but it's at least some steps you could hopefully get closer to finding if it's a solution.
Thank you so much for the call, Julia, and best of luck with your Windows 10. We have more questions for our guest, Jesse LeGrew, the Chief Information Security Officer for Madison College, including about the routers that have been proposed ban in the United States. They're the most popular router brand in the U.S. today. So what are you to do if you have a TP-Link router in your home right now? We'll get to that when we continue. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to WPR News. We're wrapping up our Tech Update Monday with Jesse LeGru, the Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. And let's go to Jim in Cottage Grove quick. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. What a nice, sunny, brisk day, isn't it, out there?
Indeed.
Yes. I wanted to make just a quick comment on this Windows 11 update and issue. I have three computers here all on 10. One you could update it to 11 if you wish to, and two of them you cannot. Microsoft offers an extension program for Windows 10 called a security extension program, and it's free. And it comes directly from Microsoft. You download it. Well, it's really not a download. You alert Microsoft what computer you have your IP address and all that. And you will continue for the first year to receive security and some system updates for Windows 10. The first year is free. I think they said the second year they may charge.
Okay.
But at least for now, you don't have to upgrade to Windows 11 if you don't want to or are unable to due to this program.
What's your game plan for your three PCs, Jim?
I installed the security extension program for Microsoft in all three.
Well, keep us in the loop and let us know how it goes. Jesse, are you familiar with the Microsoft Security Systems update?
Yeah, they usually have update extensions. Usually it is at a cost, so it's nice to hear that at least for the next year, if you do sign up, you can get some patches over the next 12 months. So it is a program that looks like it would expire in October of 2026.
Okay.
The crucial point is actually signing up. I think you do need a Microsoft.com account in order to enroll in that support. But it is available, and it would keep things running, at least at this point, probably for the next 11 months until there is something else available.
I appreciate the call, Jim. Thank you so much for the help. Let's go to Christy in Cottage Grove next. Christy, good morning.
Hi, thank you for calling. My phone's about to die. I got an email saying my Netgear Nighthawk AC1750 router can no longer be updated and it's going to expire. They did offer me a 20% discount on replacing it. What do you advise?
Great question, Christy. Jesse, what do you think?
So this is, I think any kind of home routers is kind of a challenge these days with a variety of software vulnerabilities, updates that you need to apply. And a lot of these are kind of supplied by the vendor. There's a couple different ways to kind of think about this. A device replacement could be a good option if you want to maintain at least support by the vendor. There are other options, although I think this is something that you'd want to also have if you have a local person that is tech friendly and that would be willing to help out with it, you might be able to open or use third-party software that is open source that could allow you to get support using at least the software for an extended period of time. So it does depend on whether the updates that you're looking for are really due to the hardware or due to the software. Usually it's software related, but there is something called OpenWRT, which is a free open source firmware that's available for a lot of routers that you might be able to use for this Netgear router. Once again, you can use it for a lot of different devices. It's an open source project that a lot of people like to use because it is free, and it might actually open a lot of cool options if you are one of those people that like to dive into those tech options that you otherwise might not have available. So it may give you a little bit more control over your software as well. But then you're kind of you need to use this open source software to keep things up to date. So
OpenWRT, is that what it was? OpenWRT.
Correct. Yep.
Okay.
So that's a good option, at least to have software that could maintain some level of support and might give you some more options. Granted, this is something I recommend for people who are a little bit more tech savvy that like to use it, but it can extend a little bit of the life of your device.
Well, how much have routers evolved over the past few years? If my router is more than 5 years old, is it pretty much out of date, or have routers pretty much held steady in terms of their capacity over the last handful of years?
So it probably depends on the type of router. So in this case, the Nighthawk is a wireless router. One of the challenges with wireless is the standards get updated, I would say frequently, but probably, you know, every 5 years, you're going to have a new wireless standard that's going to be a little bit faster. Mm-hmm. It's going to have different capabilities, and newer devices are going to be using those newer standards. So one of the challenges you have with an older, especially wireless router, is it may not support those newer protocols. And in a lot of cases, you actually need to replace the hardware. There's no software that's going to fix it. You just have to replace the hardware to take advantage or to have those newer, faster capabilities and protocols. So that's one of the challenges.
And it may be worth upgrading then, Christy, and I appreciate the call, because this goes straight to another story that I saw in the Washington Post. It's about TP-Link routers. The Washington Post says they're the most popular brand of routers in America today. But late last year, the Wall Street Journal reported a possible ban coming from the federal government on all TP-Link routers. In April, Bloomberg News reported on a criminal antitrust probe of TP-Link, alleging that the Justice Department said that criminal charges could be considered for TP-Link because their products were being subsidized by the Chinese government. And then at the end of October, Washington Post reported more than a half dozen federal departments and agencies backed a ban on future sales of TP-Link routers because of its connection to the Chinese government. However, no official action has been taken. What am I to make of this story if I have a TP-Link router in my house, Jesse?
And it's a really good question. From at least from my perspective, one of the risks we have, not just with TP-Link, but a lot of different technologies, is who supplies the software, the hardware, where are items manufactured. I'm sure you remember, you know, years ago about TikTok and bans around that platform due to who might have access to that information, and how is it supported. It's a similar challenge with TP-Link at the moment in terms of understanding what the influence the Chinese government does have on the manufacture or support of these devices, in addition to a lot of the components being manufactured in China, which also could open the risk for the hardware itself having maybe not built-in vulnerabilities, but built-in backdoors or capabilities that would allow somebody to make changes on those devices or collect information. So with most users, if you have a TP-Link device at home, one of the risks is somebody that you potentially don't trust may have access to information on what you're doing in terms of how you serve the web or other components. Another risk is they might use that router to try to infiltrate your network. So there's a possibility that the router itself could be, you know, it has access to all your home devices because it has to. It helps to talk between your home and your internet service provider. And this means whoever controls that device potentially has that same access. And so they could use it to try to compromise other devices, gain sensitive information, or do a variety of other things that any device on your home network could do.
Microsoft says that these TP-Link routers have been used by multiple Chinese groups on spying missions. Are they using my router, or are they looking for routers that would connect to, you know, secure government or private sector data?
I'd probably say yes. So a lot of the, I'd say a lot of the campaigns may not be specific to a particular router. So one of the things we do see from devices connected to the internet is there are campaigns happening all the time to take advantage of vulnerable software or vulnerable routers. And this isn't specific to TP-Link. It could be happening to a variety of home or small office routers that could be vulnerable to these attacks. So the fact that you have a TP-Link device could put you at risk, but it may be a similar risk than if you would have had a different vendor that's actually susceptible to that same vulnerability. So part of it is it because these devices have some kind of backdoor that's being leveraged, or is it because they just happen to be vulnerable to the same things a lot of other devices are also vulnerable to? So there's a combination of both in terms of like the risk of just having any network attached device. Maybe it has vulnerable software that just needs to be patched. And I think that's been a conversation topic in terms of the TP-Link devices. If those patches don't get released as soon as they need to, or they don't get applied as soon as they need to, you have that additional risk.
Well,
so
the security experts in the Washington Post article said that TP-Link was slow to fix flaws. And so there are some questions there. I've got a few minutes left, but Lynn's been hanging on the line. I want to make sure we get to her with the time we have left. Lynn, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. My question is about secure storage of videos, either on external hard drive or online. I had an external hard drive fail recently, and I now no longer have my videos.
Oh, Lynn, yeah. You got to back up and got to have backups for your backups, I believe, would be the issue. But how can you keep them secure? We've got about 2 minutes here, Jesse.
Yeah, there are a couple of things that I recommend. So what I currently do is I do have many hard drives at home. So in case one fails, I have the backup of another. That being said, think about what other possible issues you could run into. If all my hard drives are at home and my home has a fire, well, they could all get destroyed. Usually what I'd recommend is a combination of online storage and having some offline storage. One, because the offline storage is going to be cheaper, you're going to have easier access to it. And so it's going to be a little bit faster. And so I do recommend having that. And I'd recommend if you're able to archive it and upload to any kind of file storage service, you might already have one available that you're already paying for. If you can upload it there, I would also recommend password protecting it or anything you can do to just make sure no one else can get into that data. So as we talked about before, having a strong password, using multi-factor authentication can help to protect it. But I would use a combination of online storage and archive it or zip it if you can, which will shrink the size and save on storage and on money, and have a local backup that you can have for easier access. If you also know somebody or have a friend in the area, maybe you trade hard drives. So they might need to have backups. You need to have backups. If you swap hard drives, that means if something happens where you are, you still have a backup somewhere else. And so having things offsite can be a really nice option. And if you have somebody that's relatively local or you'd like to do that with, it can be a great offsite storage option.
So if you have something like family photos or memories that you want to make sure you keep forever in this digital age, putting them in one place probably is your worst idea.
Correct.
Yeah. That scattering them around in many places as secure as possible will be the best way to keep hold on to these things for as long as possible. Jesse, I want to thank you for joining us today, and we've got plenty more questions, so we're going to have to bring you back again on the second Monday of every month, so we'll talk to you soon.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Jesse LeGru, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College, and we thank him for answering all of our tech questions today, and we'll do it again next month. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to WPR News.